Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to start today's show with that thing we do after every American mass shooting. The mourning, the blaming, the proposing, the opposing. But maybe this time the cycle will be different. A week after the Parkland, Florida high school shooting, Washington Governor Jay Inslee repeated his call to state lawmakers. There are reasonable gun regulations. You need to enact them and forget whether you could get voted out of office for it.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whether you're going to lose your seat to some degree. If somebody's life's on the line, do your job. That's the way I feel about it.
Now, the governor says he thinks most voters are on his side of this issue. So will lawmakers in Olympia pass new gun control laws this session? Let's ask Everett Herald state government reporter Jerry Cornfield. Let's start with bump stocks. This is the device used in the Las Vegas massacre. It basically turns a rifle into an automatic weapon. Governor Inslee wants bump stocks banned. So does President Trump. Where are Washington state lawmakers on bump stocks?
They're about to send Governor Inslee a bill. I mean, there is a legislation that started in the Senate. It passed in the Senate. It had bipartisan support. It moved cleanly through the House Judiciary Committee a couple days ago. It is sitting in the Rules Committee of House, which is basically one step from getting to the floor and which it'll be voted on. Now, there is still some doubt amongst the folks whether it will pass the House. It's been one of those issues that is tough in a 50-48 divided House, but I think if it gets there, it will pass.
What are you hearing about any importance of President Trump's taking on bump stocks?
Well, Governor Inslee spoke about it yesterday, and other lawmakers have said similar statements. Washington needs to do its own thing. These are issues that the legislature can and should handle because they know about the federal government and this administration. Sometimes things are said but aren't delivered, and sometimes they take a lot longer. This is Congress, which still hasn't passed a budget. And in a couple of weeks, they could have another government shutdown because they're on a continuing resolution. So they want to do something, at least those who support the bill, and they want to do it here in Washington.
So what about opposition to a bump stock ban in Washington state? What are the most influential opponents saying?
Well, on the ban, the opponents haven't been quite as loud and forceful as they have been on other bills that are sort of stalled or not going anywhere. But it passed in a House committee with a bipartisan support. But their argument is any time you begin to put new rules and regulations on what people can do related to weapons, you're infringing on their Second Amendment rights. Another argument is that a bump stock was an aftermarket device. It's something you buy and attach to your weapon. Not a lot of people have them. While they were used in the Las Vegas mass slaying, for the most part, these are not devices that are commonly bought, sold, and used. And so they think that the target is not necessary to be targeted.
Okay, that's bump stocks. You also said, Jerry, that there are gun control measures that are stalled and not going anywhere. What's one of those?
Right. I mean, at the beginning of the session, there were really a sort of a package of four bills that were trying to be. This was one of them, banning the bump fire stocks. There was a bill to limit how many bullets in an ammunition magazine. This was another bill sought by Attorney General Bob Ferguson. There was also a bill to require responsible storage of firearms, and if you had a gun that someone obtained because you didn't store it properly and they committed a crime or injured someone, you might be liable. That bill is stalled. And then there's a fourth bill that may come back because of what happened in Florida. It enhances the background check law by extending it to those when you buy an automatic weapon. Right now you can walk into a store and if you're 18, 19, 20 years old, buy an AR-15 or automatic weapon and walk out of the store with the weapon. Unlike a pistol, which has a waiting period and a background check to see if you have any criminal record, it does not exist in Washington. It did not exist in Florida, and it still doesn't. And so there is a bill to ban people from buying those guns unless you're 21 years or older, and also to require all gun purchases to include a background check.
Why is there a waiting period and a background check to buy a pistol but not for semi-automatic rifles?
You know, federal law does have background checks for rifles and shotguns, but the state law doesn't apply. And this is another one of those areas where neither state or federal law exists. And it's just a loophole that lawmakers have been trying to fill. and they haven't been able to do so. Now what happened in Parkland, Florida, is on people's minds, and there's a lot of attention to how a 19-year-old could buy a weapon like this and legally and then use it. So I think that now a new motivation is out there around the country and maybe momentum in Washington state legislature. Only 2 weeks left in the session, so hard to know whether it will happen or not, but it's possible.
Well, as you said, the Florida gunman was 19 years old. What about the proposal to raise the age limit to buy firearms to 21?
Well, that is part of this bill that the Senator Frocht of Seattle has proposed, and that's an issue the governor has talked about as well. And all gun control supporters have talked about trying to raise the bar. I mean, there's also an effort to make it illegal to smoke unless you're 21 or over, so it made sense to talk about guns and another issue. So it's people want to see it happen. Part of the problem is these bills have restrictions that folks who are opponents of gun control say are not necessary, and they talk about other issues that need to be worked on, mental health and suicide prevention, but they're just not willing. Now, I think that's a growing, if you will, a shrinking minority, and the more and more people are realizing that you need to be a certain age to buy these weapons, or you at least need to have a background check. And so I think if it reaches the floor of the Senate and the House, it'll pass, but I'm just not sure if it will.
Jerry, let me ask you about one more gun control proposal and then some bigger picture here. There is a measure that would prevent people with a domestic violence conviction or criminal harassment from owning a firearm. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that bill, which comes out of the Senate, it was stalled, but now it seems to be moving again through the House. I think that is another one of those, I don't want to say it's a small change, but it's an important change. And to the law by expanding those crimes, which if you commit them and are convicted of them, would bar you from getting a gun. In this state, which moves through sort of incrementalism on policies like this, this feels like it's one of those steps the state's ready to make. The governor will sign it if it reaches his desk, but it just takes a little longer to convince folks and the two chambers to pass it.
You know, after the Parkland, Florida shooting, we have seen angry students yelling at lawmakers. Have there been similar protests in Olympia?
Not in that manner. There are not large protests this week, at least not have not materialized yet. There's still time. I say there's 2 weeks in the session, and if they wanted to show up, there's still time to do that. And it may be in part because when the voters have had a chance to deal with gun control legislation like the background check, Initiative 594 a couple years ago, the Extreme Risk Protection Order more recently, they both passed. And in spite of money that the NRA and gun owners groups had spent against the measure, the background check measure in particular, they passed, and they passed comfortably. So in Olympia, where the legislature is meeting, we haven't seen I haven't seen any unusual amount of increased lobbying and presence of students yet.
And that's my final question for you, Jerry. There are student protests, even in a red state, red-ish state like Florida, some walkouts here in Washington state. Governor Inslee has cited opinion polls showing that public opinion has turned to his side. So here's the question we ask after every one of these mass shootings. How much do you think has changed? How much do you think this debate is new?
Well, I think what's changed, at least from my perspective, and I think what some national journals have been saying, is that because the students are here and because they are turning their grief into action, it's catching the local lawmakers, the federal lawmakers, and even the president off guard. And I think they're now being forced to listen and being forced to comment. There have been some televised forums in which lawmakers and the president have been in the room with survivors of what happened in Parkland and being compelled to respond to their pleadings and their comments and their requests, and it's drawing them into a debate they haven't been drawn into in such a manner. So this will lead to some change. It may only be at the state levels because of what happens in Congress. We are going to see a bump stock ban in Washington and maybe more. I think Florida is going to start closing some of the loopholes in its laws. So it may happen state by state, like often does.
In Washington state, it's Jerry Kornfield covering the government in Olympia for the Everett Herald. Jerry, good to talk with you again. Thanks.
Hey, good talk with you. Thank you.
And on the national gun control debate, President Trump says today that drills that teach students how to respond if an active shooter were to enter are, quote, a very negative thing. Trump says he wouldn't want to tell his 11-year-old son that he has to go through an active shooter drill. The president said he'd prefer what he called a hardened school over active shooter drills. Trump has floated the idea of arming teachers as a possible deterrent. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Back in a moment. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Last summer, a tech worker named Madeline Parker emailed her coworkers that she was taking a mental health day. Her boss responded positively. That response went viral, partly because it's so novel to see such mental health support in the workplace. Every year, 1 in 5 Americans experience a mental illness, but there's still stigma in professional life. My next guest is the founder and executive director of the Stability Network, a nonprofit working to reduce that stigma. Catherine Switz, welcome to The Record.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Bill.
Why do you think that email exchange got such a viral reaction?
Because I think we all need a mental health day, and we all want to be able to ask for it. And so many people realize that it's impossible to do so. But the fact is, many of us need a mental health day, and we want to ask for it.
And you've had your own experience with this, Catherine. You've been open about being bipolar. And when did that first become something that you had to deal with?
Sure. I was at Harvard Business School, and I had my first psychotic break. And I think the question everybody asks is, what does that mean? And basically, I was walking across campus. It was freezing cold, and I was flailing wildly, screaming that I wanted to walk on water on the Charles River. And a few minutes later, I was in the urgent care facility, and I was actually baptizing nurses in the sink, thinking I was Jesus. And of course, they put me immediately into an ambulance to send me to a locked ward. I thought the ambulance driver was Santa, but turns out he wasn't. He took me right where he was supposed to take me. And I was there for 2 weeks recovering, and I was put on medication and all of that. And during that stay, I asked the doctors if I could get back to school. Could I go back to business school right then or when? And they frankly said, we don't even know. And for me, that was a galvanizing moment. I'm, first of all, because of my personality, it completely made me determined to prove them wrong, that I would go back. But it also has been an inspiration for the Stability Network, because I want everybody to hear the message that they can go back to school, they can go back to work. People with mental health conditions are just like anybody else, and we can work and we can be productive and we can be in community.
Were you always open about your mental health issues?
Not at all. I hid it. I was at McKinsey & Company and then GE, and I hid it. I had another psychotic break, hid it the entire time. Because I was afraid of letting them know that I had just come out of a psychiatric hospital. And it wasn't until I started to work at a series of nonprofit organizations and started to stabilize, frankly, when I felt more in a position to speak out, and that I felt like I could ask for accommodation. And I started to ask for accommodation. But even then, it was incredibly scary. And I just want to say, I have a stable husband with a stable job. I had a stable career. We had everything going for us, and it was still very hard. And that's why I started the Stability Network, because I feel like if people like me were having trouble speaking out, how would it be for a single mom? I felt like more people like me needed to speak out to pave the way for others. So if we're successful in 20 years, or hopefully 5, everybody will be able to ask for a mental health day, and Madeline Parker's experience won't be so rare.
I wonder, Catherine, you weren't always open about what was going on with you. At what point did you realize, I've got to be honest about this at work?
Well, there were two phases of it. I mean, the first time I desperately needed to ask not to travel as much internationally. And I told my boss that, and I said, I have a health condition. And he immediately asked what? And I blurted out bipolar disorder, I think sensing a receptive environment. It was a very supportive nonprofit organization. I don't recommend that people, quote, share their diagnosis first time like that. I think it is something that people want to be careful and thoughtful and planful about. But in my case,
why? What might that reaction be?
Because I think if you look at the data and the statistics, the percent of people who don't want to work alongside somebody with a mental health condition is incredibly high. Hmm. And the fact is that there is still discrimination in the workforce. There is still stigma in our society. So while I would love to wave a magic wand and eliminate all of that and tell everybody to ask for a mental health day, the reality right now in our society, in our workplaces, isn't that. And there is fear of repercussion, and there is fear that people won't be supportive. And that's, again, why I think Madeline Parker's post went so viral, because her boss was so supportive and his email was just so effusive and deeply, deeply supportive. And I think that was incredibly powerful to people.
Well, let me ask you about that, Catherine. We all know that what is in our minds causes us real suffering. So why is there such a stigma against taking a mental health day off work, as we're used to what we would separate as a physical health day?
Yes. So basically, my belief is that stigma comes when people don't understand something, whatever it is in society, when people fear what they don't know, what they don't understand. And as I mentioned in my story, I mean, psychosis is a scary thing. Suicidal depression are scary things. So I think when people see that, they don't understand it, they don't know how to deal with it, they're afraid that it would show up in themselves or in their family members. It's threatening. It's scary because people don't understand it. And that's, again, why we're trying to really get the word out that you can live with these conditions. You can be, you can live full lives. That's really our message.
Okay, so let's say I'm ready to take a mental health day, to ask for a mental health day. You said, if I have a diagnosis, don't come right out with it. I mean, how should someone handle stepping into that new territory of taking time off for my mental health?
Well, Bill, I'm just going to be really clear. I think the first thing that everybody needs to focus on is their health. So it is absolutely crucial that if you need a mental health day for whatever reason, you should take it, obviously. I prioritize my health even when I have big meetings that I shouldn't miss. It's absolutely critical that we do that so that we can continue to be functioning members of society, right? So the first thing I would say is if you don't feel comfortable asking for a mental health day, take a sick day. You know, take a personal day. Take whatever kind of day you need to take to make sure you get that time.
Even though my boss doesn't know why I'm taking it and might not think that's okay. We haven't discussed this yet, that a mental health day is a thing. Well, you're saying just do it anyway?
No, I was doing it in two steps. First, I was saying take a day. And then the question is, what do you call the day?
Uh-huh.
You call it a mental health day or not? And let me just share my experience. Even now, running a mental health nonprofit, the Stability Network, I still have trouble turning to my colleagues and saying I'm going to take a mental health day. Even though I have a mental health condition and I work in this industry, I still feel shame and internalized stigma from doing it, you know, 20 years after my diagnosis. So it's very deep and it's very powerful. So what I'm trying to say is take a day off for sure. Call it maybe not a mental health day, but take it. Take the day off.
Call it a sick day.
Call it a sick day. And then as you assess your environment and share with your boss in a different, you know, in a maybe more relaxed setting or an opportunity where you can really share. I mean, I can, again, iterate, share my experience. I mean, when I told one boss, we were at lunch, and I explained why I was having to have some accommodation that I had already asked for. But I said, you know, I want to give you a little bit more color. And this is what I have, and this is how I live with it, and this is how I stay stable, and this is how I make sure I'm still a contributing employee. This is how I manage myself. And it was an environment that was really easy to kind of share that whole experience. So what I recommend is if and when you choose to share that you need a mental health day or that you have a diagnosis or both, just think about the environment, think about the best way to set it up, and realize that the discrimination is real. I don't want to be glib and just say, Bill, anybody should just go and ask for a mental health day, or anybody should just go share with their boss that they have something. The fact is that the Stability Network is trying to be on the vanguard. We're trying to get the message out so people can take that risk. We're saying, and there are 110 of us in 50 cities, we're trying to say, we'll take the risk for you. We'll open up. We'll pave the way so that other work environments that may not be as conducive can follow along, and that everybody will be able to take that mental health day.
Well, Catherine, it seems like a key here is a diagnosis. You have had a diagnosis of bipolar illness. What if I'm just feeling exhausted, traumatized, upset, depressed, but I don't have a diagnosis? Do I have to have one or intend to go get one to take a mental health day, do you think?
Absolutely not. Mental health conditions fall on a continuum. It's just like having the flu or a cold or something else. You can have mild symptoms of sadness or upsetness or exhaustion or stress, and then you can have, deep depression. And we don't judge where you are on that continuum as to whether you take a mental health day. I mean, it's as important to do preventative work and to make sure that you get that support and take care of yourself before something gets worse.
But Catherine, you can, I'm sure, understand some people's fears of a slippery slope where, we're not going into work if we feel a mild sadness. If we feel like I haven't gotten enough, I'm depressed because I need to be outside. That's where my peace is in the out of doors. You know what I'm getting at?
Right. But I think for me, it comes down to trust and respect. And I think Madeline Parker might have mentioned this in one of her articles, trust and respect in the workforce. And also, I think we all have I don't know whether it's a moral compass or a sense of the need to be a contributing member at work. I mean, I don't think everybody's going to, I don't know the statistics on this, but when you open up workplaces, people work more, they don't work less. People want to be contributing. They don't want to take a ton of days off. So in fact, when you make that a possibility and support people to do so, I think the reverse can actually happen. Of course,
we become more productive.
Well, not only do we become more productive, but I think it's like when I know there are examples when companies give people unlimited vacation and they find people take actually less of it in some cases. So again, I don't think opening the conversation to let people take mental health days will cause people to take so many that it decreases productivity. I think the reverse will be true. People will take those preventive steps and then they'll come back to work more refreshed and ready to go.
I have an idea in my head of how sick I have to be to call in sick. How would you suggest we know if we are mentally down enough to stay home?
That's a great question. And I don't know that there's a simple answer.
There's no one answer.
Yeah. And I don't know. For me, at least, I struggle when I'm physically, quote unquote, sick as well. So, let me talk about myself. Let me explain what I do. When I am unable to work, I'm unable to focus at my computer or unable to be effective in meetings, that's when I step out. I don't step out just when I'm tired or, I really don't want to go to this meeting. Obviously, that wouldn't be a reason. But, I stare at my computer screen and I can't focus, or I'm having a panic attack or an anxiety attack, which I have less of, let me be clear. But in Madeline Parker's situation, I think she talks about that a bit more. I also like the word convulse. So when I'm feeling convulsed by anxiety or convulsed by stress or really unable to function, unable to be present for my son, that's when I'll say, let me just take a day and make sure I'm back on my game.
Catherine, I really appreciate your acknowledging that even though you've been working on this for 20 years, you still feel that internal, I think you used the word shame about this, about, pausing your work life for your mental health. What do you do about this conviction you have and this internal shame you still have?
I think what many people say is when you have shame, you do something called opposite to emotion action and you get out there and you talk about it. And I'll give you a great example. This morning, I was talking to somebody in my inner circle and I didn't want to tell them about the interview because I didn't want them to hear that I had been psychotic because they're part of my, community.
You didn't want to tell them about this conversation you and I were
right,
about to have?
Right, because I was afraid that they would judge me because mostly because of the psychotic piece. I think that's very scary to people. So here I am, again, 20 years after the diagnosis, 5 years after running the Stability Network, and the morning of a prominent interview, I still struggle. And so what do? I told her. I said, I'm going to be on this show. I'm excited, And So just getting out there, and I don't recommend that of everybody. Let me be the one to take the risk. Let the Disability Network be the ones to take the risk. I don't want the message to your viewers to be everybody should suddenly be open, and if you're not, you're somehow lesser. You know, that's even worse. When you judge yourself for not being open about your mental health condition, that's a worse spiral. We don't want to ask people to be open if they don't want to be open. We want to tell people that we are willing to be open for you so that in time the environment changes and you can be open too and get the help you need.
That's Catherine Switz, the founder of the Stability Network, and we're tweeting out a link to their site right now where you can see their list of mental health resources or book a speaker or what have you. We're on Twitter at KUOW, so join us. Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Bill Gates does not live in a food desert. He lives right down the street from the Medina grocery store. Just don't expect to bump into him there.
All right, we're going to test your knowledge of some everyday items that you get at the supermarket. When's the last time that you have been at a supermarket?
Long time ago.
Okay.
That's Ellen DeGeneres quizzing Bill Gates on the cost of living. He flunked the quiz.
How much do you think Rice-A-Roni would be within a dollar?
$5.
Okay, let's...
The audience didn't like that.
Let's see.
Ready? Not $5, actually. Rice-A-Roni just costs $1. Gates also vastly overvalues pizza rolls and spinach and artichoke dip.
You guys think less than $10?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Gates was not pretending to have the common touch. He told Ellen he has a Porsche and an airplane and a trampoline in his house, but also said that he has spent $40 billion fighting malaria and diarrhea and making new vaccines. And he said it shouldn't be all up to him. What about U.S. foreign aid?
There's a real question now whether the U.S. sort of takes this less than 1% of our budget that saves tens of millions of lives and whether we don't prioritize continuing that. So it's a hot debate, you know, in terms of is it good for America to be
right.
generous and help the rest of the world live a healthy life.
Now, as for what you can do if you're not a rich government or a billionaire, Bill Gates recommended going into your local public school or charter school and mentoring children. And you know, if you teach those kids about oral hygiene, they might grow up to know as much about dental floss as Bill Gates does.
How much would you say that floss is?
I would say $4.
Look at you! $378, that's one! All right.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. More in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Some Washington state lawmakers want to keep parts of their public records private. When lawmakers do their jobs, they keep records, emails, texts, daily calendars. Some news media want to see those documents. They say they belong to the public. A Superior Court judge agreed with those media groups, but lawmakers are appealing that ruling. Why should these records be hidden from view in some cases? Here to tell you is Democratic Representative Jerry Pollitt of Seattle. Welcome.
Hi, Bill.
So you work for the public. Why are your emails not the public's business?
Well, I think that... my emails, if they are about my position on legislation and interacting with lobbyists, are something that the public should know about. I introduced the bill that would reestablish that the public has a right to know who your legislator is meeting with. And if they're making commitments or being lobbied to take position A, B, or C, or against A, B, or C to lobbyists, you have a right to know. And I introduced that bill to reestablish that in law. But there are things that I think are very legitimately something that when a constituent writes me and says, I need help. My Social Security check isn't covering what my needs are, and we have health problems in my family, and here they are. Can you help me navigate with the healthcare authority?
Well, why not redact that constituent's name?
Well, I think that I think that people need to know that their individual communication with us about that type of personal privacy should be protected. I don't think that a lobbyist's communication with me should ever be protected from disclosure.
Okay, so what is an example? I've read that advocates of this legislative action want to exempt some records of policy development. What does that mean? Policy development sounds like a legislator's very public job that the public ought to know about.
Well, I think there's a legitimate debate to be had over how you draw the line here. When I have one staff person, I think people think out there that legislators in the state of Washington probably have, you know, big staffs or something. I have one staff person. And if I am working with her and sending emails back and forth as we try to develop how I will vote on a bill, I think that that needs to be protected so that we can develop that position and not worry about just trying to bounce ideas around having an ill effect on our ability to take final vote.
What would that ill effect be?
Well, for example, if and in this applies to all government agencies already. In the development of policy, whether you're the governor or the director of the Department of Commerce, your advice about maybe you shouldn't take this position because it could impact your ability to fund other items. That's the type of thing that we need to have give and take on. And then when I come out with the final position, it needs to be public. And if I make promises outside of that policy development with my own staff, then I believe, and the bill that was introduced yesterday does make it clear that the public has a right to know who's asking me to do what and what I tell them I will do.
Can you give me a specific example so I can understand what is the, you said, ill effect on this give and take that you want to have? How would this play out in a way that would hurt your constituents, are you saying?
Well, I think there are many times where as we develop policy, we're developing our position on a budget, we might say, I am concerned that a proposal, and I'll give you an example. Right now, I'm weighing how to vote on a bill in one of my committees. And I'm concerned about the potential impacts on several different competing policies and trying to figure out what is the best vote for my constituents. If I had to have that debate in the public with my staff, we'd probably be frozen. Our city council members are protected.
How would you be frozen? I'm almost there, but in this story, in this example you're giving, you would be frozen how in a way that would hurt your constituents?
You know, it's the same as getting legal advice. You want to be able to have the advice offered freely without any fear that having offered the advice could somehow lead to you stifling your opinion and not offering the advice.
So how would your opinion be stifled? Just give me that.
I want my staff to be able to say to me, Jerry, that is a stupid idea.
Uh-huh.
Or that's a great idea, but you know it'll cost you votes. That's real life. And then I make that decision and say, I don't care about whether or not it costs me votes. And the public knows when I take that position.
But we would see the email where your advisor, your staff member said, that's a terrible idea. It's going to cost you votes. And what's wrong with that? What's the harm done?
Well, I think when you're developing that position, for example, while we're in the middle of negotiating the budget right now, having that disclosed is very problematic while you're in the middle of going back and forth on negotiations. On the other hand, I'm a believer that when you're done, it could be disclosed. That's not what the bill introduced. That's my bill would allow that. It's not what the bill introduced today would allow.
Okay. So it makes negotiating difficult. I also want to bring in the attorney for the news media groups that I mentioned, these media groups that want to see lawmakers' emails and daily calendar notes. This is Michelle Earle Hubbard. Welcome.
Thank you.
By the way, your clients include Public Radio's Northwest News Network. That doesn't bias me. Representative Pollitt just laid out the case. He said it makes this would this move would make it hard to negotiate. You've got to sometimes be able to privately talk about choices and trade-offs with your advisors in a way that doesn't make negotiating hard. What do you say to that?
Well, there's two problems. First, this isn't Representative Pollitt's bill we're talking about. That bill would have had a disclosure once the policy decision had been reached. The bill we're looking at now doesn't. It makes it exempt forever. And the problem with this deliberative process exemption is it was meant to give breathing room to policymakers so they could decide on policy and have that time without external influences to reach a decision. It was never meant to shield all of the reasons they reached the decision, all the information that they, you know, took into account when making their decision. The bill we're looking at now absolutely shields it forever. It says we will never know that Representative Pollitt or one of his colleagues made a choice to pick option A over option P because it would have cost him votes, or he went ahead and voted anyway knowing it would cost him votes because he thought it was the right thing. We'll never know what influenced their policy decision, and that is hugely, hugely detrimental to the public. The bigger problem I have with the bill we're talking about today is, again, it's not the one that Jerry introduced. It's a bill that was introduced after all of the public hearings had closed, when there was absolutely no opportunity for public input or comment, and it sounds like it was done deliberately by leadership to prevent the public from having the chance to talk about it like they did with Representative Pollitt's bill and some of the other bills that were introduced during session and did not pass. So I see this as an incredible betrayal of the public's trust, the fact that the legislature is coming in at this late stage with this bill with no public hearing, seeking to exempt itself from the public records law to overturn a state court decision saying that four elected leaders have to produce some calendars, texts, and emails, and seeking to forever secret their policy discussions, as well as just a vast amount of records. I know it's being presented as a compromise that gives us something we wouldn't otherwise have, but that is simply not true. This is the only statute I have ever heard of where there will be absolutely no external check, no ability to challenge, because the decision is being left in the hands of the legislature to decide what will be disclosed, whether certain things shouldn't be disclosed because they will supposedly harass or intimidate, and there is absolutely no check if they themselves decide to uphold that first determination. You can't go to court. You can't go to an agency.
Okay,
there is
so let's
no
ask,
other state law where yes, that exists except so, the law they're trying to write for themselves.
So Seattle Representative Jerry Pollitt, we have a couple proposals on the table. Are you saying that if yours doesn't prevail, you would vote no against the legislation that's out there?
No. The most important thing to move forward is that all my constituents, all the constituents of every legislator in the state of Washington should have the right to know who your legislator is meeting with and what they're saying to lobbyists and what lobbyists are asking of them. That is the thing that we hear most about, and it is important to move ahead with legislation that for the first time will guarantee access to that.
So we just have a minute left, Representative. Are you a yes or no vote on this?
I'll be a yes to move ahead, but I agree with her that the bill should have judicial review. I find that particularly offensive not to have that, but it's a step ahead, and I'll keep working on this. And she knows that I was the first legislator to release my calendar and texts, et cetera, when requested by the news media.
Representative, that's our time for now. We'll keep following it together, so maybe we'll do this again. Democratic Representative Jerry Pollitt of Seattle and Michelle Earle Hubbard represents those news media groups wanting to see those notes. And I appreciate your time, both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Always wanted to play music, but don't like all that practicing? Well, maybe you can play The Laziest Instrument. That's what some people are calling a project by Thomas Duell at the University of Washington. He's come up with an instrument that lets you compose music with your mind. Just your mind. That's it. It's called the encephalophone. He's hoping it'll actually help people who've suffered a stroke or a spinal cord injury connect with music and creativity. So I visited him in his lab at the University of Washington to try it out.
I have so many questions for you, doctor. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to ask you standing up or wired up, sitting in your lab chair?
Just logistically, it might make more sense to get you wired up, because it's going to take a little while, along with the cap, which has 19 electrodes. There are three other electrodes, one on each ear and then one on your forehead.
Okay.
And they need to be gelled, so you're going to get gel in your hair. I just want to warn you, it's non-toxic. It washes out, but you'll get a little bit of gel in there.
All right. I can have gel in my hair. It's for science. It's for medical research. Okay, so I'm sitting in your low and comfy high back chair.
So the chair it's a particular chair. Reclining and having you relaxed is the best way to get the best data. The EEG is a very sensitive thing, and so it listens to the brain signal, which is actually quite quiet in comparison to a lot of other electrical signals. So just moving will create noise as well, electrical noise. So some people call this the laziest instrument in the world, because you just lay back and use as few muscles as possible.
While you're hooking me up, can you tell me, what does the encephalophone do?
We're very specifically measuring your imagining movement, and we're using that as a signal to raise and lower the pitch, musical pitch.
What happens when I think about movement?
When you think about movement, so what we're looking at is part of your motor cortex. When you're just sitting there doing nothing but you're awake, that part of your motor cortex has a pattern, and that pattern is there all the time if you're awake, but not doing anything. And then when you go to move your arm, in this case we're going to be having you think about your right arm moving. And when you go and you move your right arm, that part of the brain, the motor cortex, gets engaged. And that pattern goes away. So that pattern's kind of like a holding pattern. It's ready to go, but not doing anything. And then as soon as you start engaging that part of your brain, that signal goes away. So I can measure you using that part of your brain and then not using that part of your brain. If you go and you move your right arm, that pattern goes away. I can see that switch off. But if you think about moving, it also goes away. So you don't have to actually move, you can think about moving.
Am I going to be thinking about music, about pitch, or just thinking about moving my arm and then you turn that into music?
You're going to be thinking about moving your arm and we're going to turn that into music. However, just like
I was hoping to think, you know, to think of Girl from Ipanema and have it, you know,
have it come right out.
And
that would be fantastic. I wish we could do that. But in a way, you'll indirectly be thinking about music just like you would any other instrument. So if you had never seen a piano before and I showed you a piano, you would start to learn it by movements and thinking about movement of your hand. You'd say, I'm going to push this note and then see what it does. And you're not thinking as much about the notes, you're mostly thinking about the mechanics of it. But once you learn and you become, say, a concert pianist or something, you're no longer thinking about the movements. They come automatically. You think about music, and it's the same kind of learning curve.
Why are you so interested in music being the thing that I produce with my brain signals?
I had seen other people and artists trying to take EEG signal and turn it into music before, and just they simply didn't do it right. And I was a musician who was interested in this, so it started off sort of more like a art project. But as I started to develop it and it started to work, I realized it could be used in some of my work with patients. I deal with stroke patients all the time, patients with motor disability, they've lost the ability to move. I thought it would be great to bring the ability to make music again to people who had lost the ability. So someone who played the violin and no longer could play the violin because they've had a stroke or a spinal cord injury could make music again. So I thought that would be pretty neat. So that was one motivator. Another motivator is that the feedback that music provides, it's very powerful. We know a lot more about the power of music to motivate people and to get people to really focus on all types of tasks. And so my hope is that I'll be able to take this and not only have them play music, but eventually use it to help motivate them, get them better at controlling things with their mind, if you will, with their brain, and then use that to help them with their motor disability eventually, starting with music and then moving it on to other things.
Should we give it a whirl?
Let's give it a whirl. So the image you want in your head is one of your right arm, mm-hmm. right here. You can actually do it. Just opening and closing your hand like this.
Okay, like I'm doing now?
Yep.
Okay.
And that will generate a low note. And when you stop, you'll generate a high note.
Briefly, for the layperson, mm-hmm. why does my clenching and unclenching my hand and thinking about that, why is that generating a low note and then I stop and it's a high note?
Imagining pulling the note down, you know, that's one way to kind of tie the two together, the music and the movement. Like, I'm going to bring it down, and then I'm going to let it go and just let it drift up. And now I'm going to pull it down. That's
all right. So if I'm thinking musically, I want to lower the note, I'm going to think pull that note down.
Yeah.
Not let it go and let it float.
And so the way we start is we start with a calibration. So we need to calibrate the instrument to each person in each session. And basically we'll set it to your brain, how your brain does that. Thinking about opening and closing that right hand. We'll turn on the free play.
Okay.
So you'll just hear a note coming out every half second, so to a second.
I'm ready for my audition.
So that's you now. Try to go high. That's the high note you hit for a second.
Will you walk us through what we just heard?
Yeah, so you're hearing basically the last 500 milliseconds, half second of the signal of your brain turned into a note. So it's an average of what you were doing over the last half second. And that may not sound like a whole lot of time, but you can change things fairly rapidly in that time.
This is my kindergarten solo.
Exactly.
In The Lion King, you know, I mean, I have a ways exactly. to go.
Yeah, I've likened it to giving a monkey a toy piano.
I thought I could detect a little bit when I was going down and when I was going up, mm-hmm. but it was kind of hard to hear. How much, honestly, could you detect that I was having any control over high and low notes?
Our initial experiments that we just published a paper about a few weeks ago in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, and it was a series of experiments, carefully controlled scientific experiments, not like this, to prove that people could have some control. And what we chose were novices, like you, just in this kind of session, people who we gave 5 minutes of training on, no more, and then we had them try to match notes, and they were able to do that with some accuracy. So it's not crazy to take a total novice and have some control. Not incredible control. I think our average was around 65% or something, but that's for first-timers. If you keep training, you keep coming back and doing this, you'll get better and better.
If I quit my job, would you pay me a stipend so that I could feed my family and just get better on the encephalophone?
You know, I could use some funding. So anyone out there who, I'd be happy to pay this guy to do that.
I want to make this thing sing, people. Let's make some music.
We do have a backing track for you. So I think we should let you play live along with the backing track, and you can just kind of improvise. See what you can do.
My brain tapping into its innate musical genius and playing an instrument called the encephalophone, invented by Dr. Thomas Dewell at the University of Washington. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. That's it for today. The show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, and Jason Pagano, and our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, it's The Week in Review. Please tune in.